And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Richard Dolan with us as we talk about UFOs, crash retrievals, and special documents. We'll take your calls this hour as well. Richard, there was a case that the late James Mars used to talk about, Jim Mars, about a body in Texas of an alien that was buried and moved. Do you remember that story?
Yeah. That relates to the incident from 1897 in Aurora, Texas. And it was something that Jim got into. He actually developed a really strong interest. He didn't live far from there. He was in Texas his whole life. And what basically is said to have happened during 1897, there was a wave of what we would now call UFO sightings, airships, mystery airships. And, you know, we actually don't really have a clear idea of what those were. But in the case with Aurora, there was the claim that one of these had crashed, had hit a structure, I'm thinking windmills, I can't remember what it was, and the Martian, as it was described in the newspaper account, actually was killed. And so it was said that it was buried in town. And by the early 1970s, there were some investigators, I think with MUFON in the area there, that actually believed they'd located the grave.
It was a great story.
Yeah, and this is even before Jim got involved in it. And supposedly, and I think I'm getting this right, but I may get one or two details wrong, when they went back to exhume this, the grave had been emptied out and there was nothing there. And Jim, in later years, I think in the 21st century, did his own assessment of the case. And I can't remember if he got anything new out of there, but I know he was definitely interested in the Aurora, Texas UFO event of 1897.
One of the great stories I'll always remember, and I'm sure you know about this one, is the case of then-President Richard Nixon taking actor-comedian Jackie Gleason down to Homestead, Florida, the Air Force Base there, showing him an extraterrestrial that they had in a jar or something like that. And apparently Jackie Gleason was never the same. What was that story, Richard?
I go back and forth on that one. For a long time, I said that's absolutely true. There was a alleged manuscript I've never read, I have to just say, by Gleason's ex-wife, Beverly McKittrich, who she was his wife at the time. And apparently she did make this statement that, you know, he came back, told her about Nixon, and just actually drank for a couple of days, really tied one on as a result of that, and said he had seen a short, diminutive alien bodies, I think plural, that were in glass cases. Not in jars, as I recall, but lying down in like a glass case. I don't necessarily disbelieve it, but there are...
some inconsistencies.
There's inconsistencies about it. Yeah, there's not enough information for me to say absolutely I think it's true, but it is a fact that Gleason and Nixon were close friends. It is also a fact that they did a photo op event doing golf at that time, very close to the air base, and it is actually very well known that Jackie Gleason was a UFO expert. He had a massive library of UFO-related books, got into debates with Air Force, with skeptics, and usually won those debates, from what I heard. Gleason was incredibly knowledgeable about this. And so what you have to recognize is there's no way that Gleason and Nixon did not have some serious conversations about flying saucers and UFOs. Like, no, they did.
What a great story that could be.
I tend to believe, I believe it probably happened. I just not 100%.
To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences, that was formed in 2017 by Tom DeLonge, the rock star. What do you think of that organization? I mean, they did seem to be the ones to get the Tic Tac UFO story out to the public.
Yeah, they sure did. They have done things that no researcher, no organization has ever been able to do. And I'm just always amazed at the venom that I often hear directed at this organization. I heard so many times, they're a CIA op. And I just think, actually just listen to what they're saying and what they're doing. And They have actually moved this ball forward farther down the field than anyone that I know of. So the three videos that they got, that was really Lou Elizondo who made that happen, from what I understand. And that was a real score. That could easily not have happened.
That's right.
He made it happen and was able to release that. And eventually the Navy released their own version of that, but it was exactly the same. But it's all Elizondo. And, you know, they have their own approach to this. They're really not trying to talk to the public, at least it doesn't seem like that to me, or even too many other researchers. They are trying to get political movement on this in their own way. And I don't see them as a disclosure organization per se, but they are definitely, you know, Chris Mellon. I mean, you can read some of his statements on the TTSA website. They're really quite remarkable.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the things that he's been recommending are now in that Senate intelligence bill that we talked about earlier. So I think, yes, this is actually where we are now in 2020 compared with where we were 3 years ago before they hit the scene.
What did you think of the theories of the late Zachariah Sitchin, Richard, that we were seeded by the Anunnaki? He was pretty compelled that it was true.
Yes. What I actually have come to, I've really started to revisit the idea of ancient seeding. And it's not that I, you know, I can't pretend that I know. I mean, I wasn't there, and I'm just looking at the best evidence that I can. But Sitchin, I go back and forth on. I'm actually somewhat hesitant about him. But I do know that in our development, there's a friend of mine who actually died many, many years ago. She was a scholar here in Rochester, New York, where I live. Her name was Colleen Clements. And she looked into this theory of ancient seeding of humanity. And I think she did a pretty good job pointing out that there's a particular, something known as an allele in our microencephalon gene, which regulates brain growth, brain development. And that this allele has been proven to be only maybe roughly 40,000 years old, maybe a little older, a little less. And it coincides with the development of tremendous human creativity and all that. Well, the thing is that geneticists have determined this allele could only have been introduced externally, that is through interbreeding. And so when you look at what are the candidates, there's Neanderthal, and that's about it. But was it the Neanderthal? What geneticists have, they have not been able to find that allele in the Neanderthal DNA, and we have Neanderthal DNA. We've been able to study it for years, and it's just not there. So the question is, where did it come from?
That's right.
If it definitely came from an external source, well, Colleen's theory was that it may very well have come from extraterrestrial. And if that's so, we were seeded. We were a project. I think it's an interesting theory, and it can't be proven yet, but it is a fact that the Neanderthals are not known to have had that allele in their gene, and we have it, and we don't know who's the daddy.
And could those who seeded us, could they be some of the ones that are coming back on a regular basis, monitoring us, just checking in?
In the years past, I would have been very hesitant and uncomfortable to try to speculate along these lines, but I try to be very factually based in what I say about this subject. But I do think it's fair to speculate as long as you're clear about it. And I think, yes, we probably have been monitored for a very long time. But I think probably for most of our history at a very low level, in the sense that humanity just wasn't that interesting for a long, long time. We were operating at a very low level. But in the last couple of centuries, and in the last one century especially, we have kicked it up. And we've revolutionized our entire civilization and indeed our whole species. So I think now we're very, very interesting. And I think that does coincide with a dramatic uptick in UFO sightings and encounters of all types. So I think that we're getting the attention very probably of multiple groups that are able to observe us and that find us quite interesting.
You have talked about the fourth stage of humanity. What do you mean by that, Richard?
Yeah, this is something I've been really mulling over recently. So when I look at the long, long course of human history, I mean, we have lived as a species in this form, as far as anyone can tell, for about 200,000, maybe a little bit more than 200,000 years. And in all of that history, I would argue that we have actually had exactly three fundamental modes of existence, only three. And for most of those 200,000 years, it's been hunting and gathering. You know, that's how human beings, that's how we, our bodies are designed, that's what we've done. We hunt and we've gathered. And only about 10,000 years ago did we start something radically new, our second stage of existence, which was agriculture and farming and raising, livestock and forming the first cities and all of that. There's a tremendous continuity of that. Yes, a lot of variety, but tremendous continuity. Then about 300 years ago, we started what we would call our third stage of history, which we can call science and industry. And that's a radical transformation of the human condition and human situation. And I believe that we are now in the transition at this moment into the fourth stage of humanity. And I don't really know if I have the best name for it, but right now I'm just calling it the transhumanist stage. But it involves much more than just biological changes, although it does. But it involves in the near term something much more dramatic, frankly, which is a completely new type of infrastructure, which is revolutionizing our entire civilization. So we're going to have universal 5G, which means 24/7 surveillance, which means complete tracking of every single person, total control through whether it's social media or digital footprint. And it means so many other things that are going in with the smart devices that will just ultimately monitor us all the time. On top of which, what some economists are calling the robo-apocalypse, that is, Terminator's coming not to kill you, but just to take your job. And we are essentially economically in a game of musical chairs where someone keeps taking the chairs out, but you still have the same number of people. And the chairs that remain are not all fun to sit in either. So we're moving to a society where people are going to be much more dependent. This is why you've got folks talking about universal basic income, because the recognition is there's just not going to be jobs and opportunity. We're moving into a highly bureaucratized control, sanitized, in my opinion, kind of world, and that is moving us to this, what I call this transhumanist fourth stage. And it does involve biological changes as well, all of it. And, you know, we can't see it happen because we're living in it. And, you know, today feels like yesterday, and tomorrow looks kind of like today. But when you take a few steps back, you can see this is a dramatic transformation of the very foundation of what it means to be a human being. And I can't think that it's simply a coincidence that we're hitting this just as we're moving full speed ahead on the UFO matter as well. I don't think that that is a coincidence.
It's really moving. Let's take some calls here, Richard. First-time caller Ty in Tampa, Florida is with us. Hi, Ty. Welcome to the program.
Hey, fellas. Hey, thanks for having me on. It's really an honor.
Thank you.
First time I'm calling in. I'm surprised it got through. Maybe you guys could help me out with something. I remember listening to a case where I believe a Japan Air 747 was flying over Alaska, and I believe NORAD was tracking a blip on in trail static, and I believe the jet was flying at something like 500 knots. And then at one point during the track, the object moved forward and passed the jet at an incredible rate of speed. Now, this is just one instance, and I know that there's a lot more of them, and I just can't remember what they are. But what we don't hear is when these things move at such a great rate of speed, and they're solid objects because NORAD and Alaskan radar tracked a thing for half an hour in trail of the jet. There's no sonic boom, and there's no sonic shockwave.
Yeah, let me jump in with that. You got a lot of that right. There are a couple of details that I think were not precisely correct, but you are referring to a case from 1986. It's known as the JAL 007. That's Japan Airlines. And this was a large commercial airline. There was actually transporting expensive French wine, I believe, from Japan to, I guess, Alaska. And for 29 minutes, the flight did track an incredibly bizarre couple of objects that were in front of the cockpit for quite some time that were visible, that actually bathed them in green light. There was an enormous object that these two smaller ones seemed to be connected to that was gargantuan in size. The pilot was in radio contact with, I think you're right about NORAD. I don't have that case in front of me, but there were at least two ground-based radars that were getting this. And, yeah, it was a heck of a case. And as far as the speeds, there was definitely maneuverability that was not understandable at all, because there were these small objects that would be in front of the cockpit and then would maneuver around. And, like, how is that possible? So that pilot was actually relieved of duty, of flight duty, for quite some time, until there was actually a petition to get him back off the desk and back in the air. There was nothing wrong with him. And there was a very interesting follow-up of that. There's an FAA official by the name of John Callahan, and he's gone on the record about this a number of times, talking about the aftermath of how they were all ordered by what appeared to be CIA into silence on this case. Callahan, you can find him on YouTube. There's video of him talking about this quite a bit. So it's a fascinating case, and definitely the case was covered up by the intelligence establishment. And furthermore, you had active disinformation coordinated by Philip J. Klass, who is the leading debunker.
Oh, he hates these stories, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he got an article in the New York Times to throw all kinds of cold water all over this case. So there's anyone with a brain could see this man was working hand in glove with the U.S. intelligence community at that time.
Richard, we're going to take a quick break and come back with final phone calls in just a moment. Those of you on hold, we'll get to you when we come right back. Richard Dolan, our special guest tonight. His books are available still, UFOs and Disclosure in the Trump Era, Russia's USO Secrets. Those are submergible UFOs, of course. His website, richarddolanpress.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Richard Dolan. Richard, one of the cases that I just love, and you'll know this, of the young guy back in October of 1978 flying a Cessna in Alaska, Frederick Valentich. He was an Australian pilot, simply just disappeared. But didn't he report seeing something coming his way?
Absolutely, yeah. He was flying from near Melbourne in the southern coast of Australia to Tasmania, toward Tasmania, across the Bass Straits, it's called, and he was lost over there. It's a body of water. He was in touch. He was a young man, but he wasn't an experienced pilot, but he was a dedicated, serious young pilot working to get his accreditation, and this was just part of his training. And he's in radio communication with traffic control in Melbourne, and he's talking about an object that's zooming around him, and he's saying, you know, is there any known traffic out here? And he keeps getting the answer, no, there's not supposed to be anything there. It's a very disturbing case. The transcripts exist. They've been reproduced many, many times. There is not an actual recording that is out there. There's a actor recreated recording. Some people get confused and think it's the real thing. But it's a very disturbing event. And my understanding, I've been to Australia a couple of times now, talked to some of the researchers close to that case. My understanding is that there's still information that they are aware of that has not really come out, but it's definitely confirming to them that he had a legitimate UFO encounter. Jeez. And was lost.
Why take him if they did that?
Yeah, it's a question I asked myself, George, because that's not the only instance of an aircraft essentially getting gobbled up, swallowed up by a UFO. There's a case over the Great Lakes in the 1950s with a pilot named Felix Moncla. Traffic controllers watched, or radar operators, saw the two blips merge, and that was the end of Felix Moncla. The one conclusion might be that there is a group out there that is aggressive or treats us as if we're simply property or doesn't necessarily see us as on equal terms with them, and they do what they want. I don't know what else it would be. I mean, in the case of Valentich in 1978, this guy was clearly being harassed
by something,
by an object.
Yeah,
by something.
Let's take some more calls. Here we go to Peter in California. Welcome to the program. Hi, Peter. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I've been listening to your program over the past few days. I'm a security guard. I work the night shift, and I discovered your program, so I've been listening to it. I'm calling because I've actually seen UFOs myself a few times. I haven't seen one in, like, about 20 years, but I saw them a couple of times when I was, like, growing up in Florida. I used to live in a place called Panama City.
Know it well.
I was growing up in a trailer park, and I actually saw one land in the middle of the street, and nobody else saw it. I don't know why I saw it, but I was playing, like, Nintendo or something with my twin brother, and he saw it too, and we heard something. We went outside. We saw it land. We actually saw inside. They looked kind of like, I guess you could call – you could say they looked like the kind of like the creature from the Black Lagoon, and then, like, it took off after that. And then, like, another time, I was in the car with my parents, and we were driving, and I saw, like, a ship, like, hidden behind some trees. It was partially hidden, but I still saw it, and I saw inside of it, and they looked similar to the other time that I talked about.
How big was the craft, Peter? How big? How would you estimate it, the size?
Well, the first one didn't seem that big. It probably was about, you know, twice as big as a car, maybe. And the second time I saw it, I saw one. The other time I saw it was, like, hidden behind some trees, but it looked a lot bigger than the first one that I saw.
Richard, don't we get a lot of reports of smaller UFOs that I'm convinced are coming from a larger mothership circling the planet?
Yeah, we absolutely do. By the way, I really enjoyed hearing both of your accounts, sir. And the thing that struck me about your manner of describing it is, like, you had no hesitation whatsoever, and you come across as someone who really genuinely saw it. So I'm glad you told your account. There's absolutely, you get cases of these smaller objects. That's the majority of UFO sightings are of craft that are, you know, smaller than 30 feet in diameter. But every now and then you get reports of something really substantially large. And you study this long enough, you get all of those directly from witnesses. So a lot of activity going on.
Case.
Interesting story.
Are we getting anybody doing investigative work with abductions? We've lost Bud Hopkins. We've lost John Mack. Who has replaced them in that area, Richard?
I'm a big fan of the work of Kathleen Martin, who I think does really fine work with abduction. There's also Yvonne Smith. California. I think Yvonne does very fine work. She's careful. There are others out there that I think are good, but in my opinion, Yvonne and Kathleen are the two leading ones right now. But we need more. We need more individuals.
Absolutely.
Who are skilled, qualified to be able to talk to folks who've had apparent abduction and encounter experiences.
Let's go to Cody in Crestview, Florida, east of the Rockies. Welcome to the program, Cody.
Hey, George. Hey, Richard.
Hi there.
Good to talk to both of you.
Thank you.
I had a question for Richard.
All right.
I was wondering if you were familiar with a case in Adak, Alaska, in 1976 involving naval personnel. I worked out there in 2013. It's a very, very strange place. It's an abandoned naval base. Cold War era.
Email, Cody?
And I know
was
for
that you?
Certain.
Cody, did you send him an email? Somebody sent him an email about that sometime ago.
I did, actually.
Is that you?
I sent you an email recently.
Yeah.
I didn't know if you'd received it.
I read it. I did get it. And I thought, I'm really glad this guy wrote to me. So I apologize for not getting back to you just yet, but it's actually been very high up on my reply list. I haven't really studied it yet, but I went through the case, and it looks absolutely fascinating. Adak, Alaska, I am familiar with its location, and it is absolutely remote, way out on the Aleutian Islands, out in the middle of the Pacific. And I think, as you said to me, it is the westernmost United States location where anyone lives. Is that right?
Sure, yes, sir. It's within spitting distance of Russia. I believe the only other American territory is the Coast Guard station, about 20 to 30 miles away.
Well, you sent me the email, and actually I have it, and it's starred. It's checked on my mailbox, but I just have not been able to get back to you. But you're one of the few that actually was able to get to me directly, and I'm happy to be able to read it. And if you wanted to tell us about it, from what you know, that I'd be interested, but I will definitely privately talk with you about this as well.
Yeah, let's do that. And are you constantly soliciting new UFO stories, Richard?
Yes, I actually am. I'm always interested. And in fact, if I may be permitted to cut out a request here, I would really be grateful.
Of course.
On the last page of the Eric Davis notes on the Thomas Wilson meeting, it's 13 pages of notes. It's 15 total because he includes 2 pages of a letter. But on page 15, there is a reference to a Mary Elizabeth Elliott in here. And it's one of these things that those of us looking into this, we have not been able to identify this individual. Everyone else mentioned in that document we pretty much got a good handle on. We don't know who this Mary Elliott or Mary Elizabeth Elliott is, and she seems very, very interesting. So I'm asking if there is anyone out there who knows who this woman is, if she is alive, if she gets this, I would like to hear from her or from someone who knows her. Please email me. This statement that is in the notes, apparently from Thomas Wilson to Davis, is, Mary Elliott sounds like real deal based on her info and behavior. And then Davis says probably will only come totally clean on her deathbed 30 years from now. This is in the notes.
I think you're getting
what she is, who she is.
You're getting a lot of serious UFO stories these days, Richard. Much more, I think, than we did years ago.
Yes, and I get them, and other researchers are getting them. I honestly, George, every day, every week, it's very difficult for me to keep up because there's other things that I'm always trying to do, and yet there's new information constantly coming in. And most of it is really, really interesting. And so now I've got a small team of people actually who are helping me out. I have a website, Richard Olin Press, and I have another website, Richard Olin Members, and I've got a team of outstanding volunteers who are actually filtering a lot of information for me because it is too much. And they're doing a great job of getting me the cases and the information that they feel is most useful. They've got their guidelines. They know what I'm looking for. So they're doing a good job at sending things to me.
West of the Rockies, Scott's with us in Boise, Idaho. Scott, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Appreciate it.
Sure.
I believe that any extraterrestrial disclosure or acknowledgement will not come from any governmental agency. It'll come from the Vatican, and it would be more globally accepted. Your guest comments on that.
Okay. The Vatican. Will they come forward with anything, Richard?
Well, it's an interesting way to look at it because I am in agreement, at least in the sense that I don't see motivations coming from any government, and that especially includes the United States government, on the matter of UFOs. I've never seen a motivation there. There's too much to lose. Now, that doesn't mean that it won't happen from a government. We're in a very turbulent time in human history, and a lot of things are up for grabs, in my view. As far as the Vatican, well, it has the advantage of being, I think, the longest continuously operating major institution on the planet, as far as I know. 2,000 years is pretty much a long time. And there's a lot that is known there. There's very little question in my mind. Whether the Vatican would do it or not, you know, there have been some interesting people high up in the Vatican over the last generation who very clearly have had a strong interest in UFOs and people with an ear to the Pope.
Sure. Was that Balducci?
Corrado Balducci comes to mind most obviously. He was a very, very engaged person. But then you've got Vatican astronomers, and there's clearly some knowledge there and an interest. Whether they would do it, whether anyone would do it, is really the question. The United States has got its listening posts everywhere on this planet, and, well, there's just not a nation or place that's going to do it if without the U.S., NSA, and other agencies knowing about it, in my view. So if they're going to do it outside of the U.S. structure of power, they have to genuinely be outside that structure of power. So that leaves Russia, that leaves China, maybe a couple of smaller countries, and, yeah, maybe the Vatican. That's possible. That is possible. Whether they would do it is another question. I don't know.
Richard, in your personal opinion, what do you think is going on?
What do I think, or when? I'm sorry.
What do you think's happening? We're being visited, where they're coming from. What are they, planetary as opposed to dimensional?
Honestly, if I were to give my most honest position on this, I think we're dealing with highly, highly advanced extraterrestrials that have abilities to manipulate space, time, and consciousness, and maybe even more than that in ways that we just cannot really grasp. And I think that they find us of supreme interest. I think they find this planet of very great interest. Some people think, why would they find us interesting? We must be like termites compared to them. I beg to differ very strongly. I don't think that is the case at all. I think that we have a very beautiful world here.
Yep.
And we have a beautiful environment. And if they have the ability, avatar-like, to get into human bodies or to find a way to live here, this would not be a bad outcome for them, in my view. And whether that's definitely the case, I don't know. But I will say this, one thing I've had to come to grips with in the last, really, couple of years is the overwhelming number of human-looking occupants of UFOs. No one ever wanted to talk about this. I didn't want to talk about it. Everyone wants to focus on the little gray aliens and reptilians and whatnot. But the fact is, close to half of all reported encounters of people who claim to have been on a craft describe human-looking beings.
That is an amazing story. Richard, let's keep in touch. Maybe I'll see you at some event somewhere, okay?
George, the world will one day right itself. I've got to think that, and when it does, we'll see each other again.
You got that right. Richard Dolan, one of the experts on UFOs, all his information at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, Cindy Dale joins us. Energy healing for trauma, stress, and chronic illness. Boy, do we need this right now.